When a report filled with unsubstantiated allegations of Donald Trump's relationship with the Russian government began circulating throughout various media outlets, most of them declined to publish the material. But one online publication did. Why did print media approach the matter with a high degree of caution? And was it a good idea? That's ahead today on The Stack. From Midori House in London, this is The Stack, 30 minutes of print industry analysis. I'm Ben Rylan. Coming up a little later in the program, we'll hear from two of the people behind the Minalima Design Studio. The House of Minalima is always a popular destination for curious onlookers passing through London's Soho. And if you like their prints, you'll love their books.
It's a really important part of the creation of a prop in order to tell the story. So if it's a book that's from the 17th century, we need to try and describe its history in that one prop.
That's coming up a little bit later. But first, a debate over journalistic ethics erupted this week after BuzzFeed took a decision to publish, in full, an unsubstantiated report detailing Donald Trump's alleged relationship with the Russian government. The Guardian was one of many media outlets taking a critical tone, with head of media Jane Martinson saying that printing unverified claims, no matter how newsworthy they may appear to be, damages proper journalism. The New York Times was also quick to point out the many ethical questions raised by BuzzFeed's decision. So, would this have played out differently if a print newspaper had got hold of the report first? Stephen Erlanger is the London Bureau Chief for the New York Times. He joins me on the line now. Stephen, good to have you on the show. BuzzFeed did include a reasonably clear disclaimer in its posting of the report. They wrote in part that the dossier includes specific unverified and potentially unverifiable allegations, and that their reporters in the US and Europe have been investigating various alleged facts in the dossier, but that they have not verified or falsified them. Is that not clarity enough?
Well, everyone makes their own judgments. We wouldn't have done what BuzzFeed did. Most so-called mainstream media wouldn't have done what BuzzFeed did. I mean, we have pretty strict rules against publishing unverified, anonymous, damaging information about anyone. So they did it to make a fuss. They did it for clicks. They did it for attention. They did it, they say, for issues of transparency.
It's interesting to compare this to the report that supposedly provoked BuzzFeed to do this, and that was the report published by CNN, which was written in part by Carl Bernstein. Do you think that the original report by CNN also perhaps was fanning the flames of something that should have been left alone?
No, I'm not saying it should be left alone. I mean, there's a difference between reporting on something carefully and simply putting out 35 pages of unredacted documentation, which could get sources into trouble, which could clearly get other people into trouble, and which is unverified. I mean, there's a big difference there.
Looking at this and comparing it to other times in history where certain information has been leaked and that has led to something happening, if we compare it, for example, we just referenced Carl Bernstein. Let's think about how the Watergate scandal eventually erupted. How different are the ethical questions we're talking about here to cases like that in the past?
Well, you know, these are hard questions, and I'm not a moral judge. And, you know, the thing about journalism is it's less of a profession than a craft. I mean, people kind of, we talk about ethical rules as if everyone shares them, but that's simply not true. I mean, each organization, in a sense, is responsible for its own behavior and conduct. And, you know, I'm not a judge of BuzzFeed. BuzzFeed did what it did. I'm just explaining to you why we wouldn't have done it. The Watergate business, you know, was before I became a journalist. But, you know, it was based on a lot of really tough digging and a lot of hard questioning and a lot of editing by some very skeptical Washington Post editors in their prime who knew the dangers of going after people high up in the White House. And so there was a kind of testing of information that, you know, hasn't happened in the case of this full publication.
There could also be the argument that regardless of the journalistic ethics that BuzzFeed have perhaps not taken notice of or taken notice of and decided to go against, regardless of those, the publishing of the report has allowed certain questions to be given a little bit more credence than perhaps they have had in the past. Do you think perhaps the cultivation of this culture of misinformation that has been done by Donald Trump himself, is that to blame in part for BuzzFeed's decision? Perhaps if it had been another presidential contender, someone who is a little bit more like what we're used to, perhaps they wouldn't have taken this step. Is that a pointless hypothetical to be wondering about?
It is. I mean, I could escape it by simply saying ask BuzzFeed, but that's a bit unfair. I mean, it just seems to me there's so much controversy around Donald Trump, so much confusion about why he has this bromance with Vladimir Putin, right, which is not a very Republican kind of attitude to take normally, and has created issues within his own party. So one of the great mysteries, at least unexplained, has been what is the attraction? You know, why is he praising Putin all the time and diminishing in importance things that other people, both Democrats and Republicans, think is really important, like the annexation of Crimea and the war in Ukraine and the shooting down of the airliner over Ukraine. So these legitimate questions, and everyone's trying to figure out an answer. Now, one possible answer raised by this, you know, private intelligence report, which, remember, was at first commissioned to do damage to Trump, is one that he was complicit with the Russians in the leaking of the hacked emails from the Democratic National Committee. That, to me, is the most important of the unsubstantiated allegations, but quite an interesting one. And the second, about whatever shenanigans he may or may not have gotten up to in hotel rooms, is very sexy seeming, but isn't very important.
The argument could potentially be made with the way that BuzzFeed has done this is that they didn't actually publish it. All they did was link through to something that was already readily available on the internet. I mean, it was published in PDF format on a separate website that was then embedded inside BuzzFeed's website. I mean, just that explanation is a lot more complex than the process that a newspaper would have had to go to actually put it on its own printed page. Does that hold any water?
I'm not sure it does, frankly. I mean, a lot of people had seen it, right? I personally hadn't seen it in London, but, you know, some of our reporters had seen it. They'd seen versions of it. There had been a redacted version going around, which actually cut out a lot of the sourcing that BuzzFeed didn't redact, which you could argue would put some sources into danger. I mean, one of the things that seems very clear is this guy, Christopher Steele, whose name was actually kept secret by Mother Jones, which was the first that I know of to write about this document at the end of October. But Mother Jones was very careful, who had met with Christopher Steele, was very careful not to use his name or his nationality. And even BuzzFeed didn't really do that. It was the Wall Street Journal that finally did that. So, you know, we've all made our own little decisions as we've gone along.
Stephen Erlanger at the New York Times, thank you very much for joining us on The Stack. Radio Times magazine was once a familiar title on coffee tables all across Britain, and while its circulation isn't what it was, the brand still boasts enough strength to make it a lucrative investment for one German media company. Hubert Berta Media bought the magazine's publisher, Immediate Media, this week in a deal that will also see it take over Top Gear magazine and BBC Good Food, among others. A little earlier, Monocle's editor-in-chief Tyler Brulain discussed the deal with Tom Edwards.
It's quite an interesting story, and certainly sitting in a market like where I am in northern Italy, in South Tyrol, which of course is largely German-speaking, and you just see the presence that Berta has in this market, of course, with their German titles. But this is a company which, of course, has its, at the beginning of the last century, it has its roots in publishing. It is a company which has been very aggressive on the digital side. And in fact, I will be at their DLD conference in Munich next week. Our Danny Giacopelli is also going to be there. So I think you'll probably be hearing a few reports, maybe even early as Sunday, but certainly across Monday, the core component of that conference. And Bird has been very active in a digital space, you know, investing in a lot of areas, but still the cash cow, what is throwing off money and certainly, you know, driving the $2 billion plus that company has in revenues is still print. So interesting that they swooped in, and there wasn't a lot of buzz about it. That's what I thought was interesting as well. You know, oftentimes this was a deal of scale. It was depending on what currency we want to look at it in, but, you know, £260 million, you know, north of $300 million, and a company as well, immediate. And this is obviously the spin-off of BBC's magazine group. And, you know, as you know, Tom, they've of course they've been acquisitive as well. They've bought up you know, other components of other media and publishing groups as well. So they've got about 60 or 70 titles. But what's interesting when you look at the revenue numbers, not insignificant, you know. £40 million profit is really nothing to sneeze at. But then if you look at the scale of the deal, you know, I think that they got it for a song. And this is what's curious, and it's the thing which I think frustrates a lot of us in this business. We talk about the media space. We can look at SoundCloud, good supporters and friends of ours as well, and we look at the delirious valuations that are going around that business, not profitable, and making and really enormous losses. So, you know, not huge revenues and very, very significant losses. And yet people are talking about, is that business worth $700 to $1 billion with no future of a revenue stream?
And Tyler, it's interesting, isn't it? If we look at, you know, Hare Callan and others within Birder, they have quite an interesting take on, you know, some of the digital challenges to the traditional players. And I mean, they echo, again, views that we've heard from you, I guess. You know, it's particularly looking at these new so-called content, what would you call them, distributors, I guess, who don't take proper responsibility, who aren't really executing editorial oversight. So they're very clear about how this marketplace is shaping up, aren't they?
They're very focused, and I think if you look at, there's a, you know, broader story, and I think we've touched on it a little bit in the forecast, but I think, you know, certainly since the last quarter of 2016, we've been talking a lot about, you know, keep an eye on Germany, whether it's the automotive sector, whether it's what's happening in aviation and transport. This is a market that we, you know, and it's certainly, we'll probably, you know, hear certainly by Monday, if not over the weekend. You know, Germany's also had a massive budget surplus this year. You know, we're talking billions and billions, which is a story that I think they'd love to be talking about in the UK or many other European markets. So Germany as an engine, interesting to look at. Germany, but certainly as a media machine, because now what you have, Tom, is a huge player like Bauer. So the biggest player, when you look at the overall glossy sort of popular section of the newsstand in the UK, you've got a massive player like Bauer out of Hamburg. Now you've got the southern flank, Birder out of Munich, you know, also swooping in on the UK. You've got Bauer being, you know, a massive player in Australia, the biggest publisher of glossies now in that market. You've got Birder then, you know, a little bit up the street in Singapore. And I think on it goes. You of course have the likes of Gruner and Jahr, you know, very big across a number of markets elsewhere in Europe, France, of course, the home market of Germany, Eastern parts of Eastern Europe as well. And I think it's not over yet. I think that we're going to, you know, we've even seen Handelsblatt, the most important daily newspaper. Their daily news letter that they deliver now in English, which is a combination of both Handelsblatt and also Wirtschaftswoche, the Business Weekly, moving into an English language territory. And I think amidst everything else we talk about within our brand, I think it's very important that there is a very strong and a very persuasive English language voice, which maybe doesn't come out of an English-speaking market. And that's an interesting role that Germany is starting to play.
And Tyler, just on that, you mentioned obviously where you're sat in Northern Italy, and Monocle's is very international, but we're obviously headquartered here in London. What about what this says about the sort of British picture? Because obviously there's a lot of speculation and conjecture really about Britain post-Brexit and how attractive that is as an investment opportunity broadly for other businesses. But it was interesting what Paul Bernard Callanan had to say about that vis-a-vis this deal, because he said, look, okay, times are uncertain, but it's not necessarily more uncertain than elsewhere. And ultimately, our investment is in good businesses is in great people. Should we be, I don't know, should we be reassured by that? Or are you wary about looking at direct foreign investment of this type and saying, oh, well, you know, all could be well?
No, I think that this was a good deal. I think that's the principal thing. If you look at the multiples surrounding it, I think that they, and this was, of course, being sold by a private equity group, then a professional media player coming in. So I think, first and foremost, good deal. And of course, we hear all, you know, the language that surrounds these deals. We're investing in good brands and people. And of course, one would hope that they are doing that as an astute media company. I think that this is unique, potentially. Mm-hmm. I don't know that we're suddenly going to see U.S. companies and other people sort of wading in to pick up other brands, of course, in the television space. A lot of talk around what might happen with ITV. So I think there was two things. Maybe we had the private equity firm, you know, deciding they want to cut and run and get it while they can. And then, of course, you've got Berta, though, which is a real traditional publisher in many ways as well. So, you know, we always talk about efficiencies, Tom, when deals like this happen. What's interesting about Berta is that they own their own printing presses still. They are vertically integrated. They've got distribution. They've got the muscle in terms of a massive digital business. So I'm not saying that printers are going to lose their jobs in this country, but I can't imagine, of course, where there are also cost upsides in certainly infrastructure that Berta owns right now, that we could also see them, you know, putting a lot of these titles on German presses or presses elsewhere within their network. So I think that they probably see that there's a lot of efficiencies. And that doesn't mean cuts in quality. I think it's just the basics of buying paper, printing magazines, logistics, where a lot of the cost is, of course, you know, sitting in all of these businesses, that there's something there. And so I think it's unique. I don't want to sort of, you know, put a downer on it. I think this was just a good old-fashioned, astute business deal. And who knows, you know, there could be a couple of others on the horizon, because I think the one thing we do know that's happening in the UK is there's also not an investment in the tools that we need to get magazines out. What we hear time and again is that printers are not investing in new presses. They're not investing in new technology. That is happening in Germany still, because there's still a belief that people do want to read off the good old page.
Exactly. A good note on which to end. Tyler, good to speak with you as always. Just tell me, where will we find you next time? Been charting your course well around Europe and around the globe. Do we know where we'll be alighting at the same time next week?
I think next week we could be in Berlin, so we could have a little bit of a check-in from the Hauptstadt of Deutschland. But I could be in hippie country. And a hippie country, that's not Northern California.
with an I, yeah.
I might be in Helsinki next week as well. Just depends. And then it's a little stop in Asia the week after that. Or actually, no, I'll probably be in the small Welsh principality that happens to be on College Street in Toronto the week after. I'm going to be I'll be visiting our Thomas Lewis, and then back at base after. By then, I think a 6 weeks absence from London.
That's a fair old stint. Well, we look forward to hearing from you or seeing you, whichever happens next, Tyler. Good to speak with you as always.
Thanks, Tom.
Tyler Brulé chatting to Tom Edwards. Still to come on The Stack, we'll hear from two of the people behind the beautiful designs at Minalima.
Press briefing on Monocle 24, brought to you by The Stack. The longtime managing director of Condé Nast is stepping down after 28 years at the company. Nicholas Coleridge will depart his roles at both Vogue and GQ as of this August, before taking over as chairman of Condé Nast Britain until at least December 2019. Coleridge was a columnist for the London Evening Standard in the 1980s, before he became editor of Harper's and Queen. He was the driving force behind the launch of the UK editions of Vanity Fair and Glamour, and also oversaw the introduction of Condé Nast Traveller and GQ Style. The chairman and the chief executive of Condé Nast International, Jonathan Newhouse, said that Coleridge has earned the highest level of respect and admiration from his colleagues, friends, clients, and most of all, from me. Nicholas, take a bow. And a backlash over a controversial media law in the United Kingdom is continuing to grow. The law, known as Section 40, was introduced following the Leveson inquiry into press misbehaviour that followed Britain's phone hacking scandal. Fears are that the law could force publishers to pay the costs of the people who sue them, even if they win. A writer for Private Eye, Francis Ween, was cited by The Guardian recalling a five-month legal battle that resulted in the court appeal ruling that the magazine's report was in the public interest. Costs were reimbursed and the article was published. He continued that, Had Section 40 been in force, despite the court's finding, Private Eye would have had to pay all the costs, a total of £350,000. Private Eye, The Guardian and the Financial Times are among the media outlets that have announced their opposition to the law.
This is The Stack on Monocle 24. I'm Ben Rylan. The award-winning design studio Minalima is the creative culmination of two artistic wizards. Mirafora Mina and Eduardo Lima joined forces in 2002 after they were presented with the kind of challenge many could only dream of, to create the graphic print imagery of the Harry Potter universe. Today, the studio publishes various books and prints with much of their work on display at the House of Minalima in London's Soho. The firm recently worked on the film Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them, with 40 of the original prints they created now on display. Eduardo and Mira spoke to Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco.
The joy for us as a design project was that in J.K. Rowling's fiction about Harry Potter, she bases everything in a very, very close to reality. If you think about it, it's not, say, like Lord of the Rings, which is a completely altered universe, or Star Wars or some other big franchises. It gives the readers and viewers very concrete realities that they can identify with and then twist them a little bit. And I think that's why people find it so easy to enter into the whole world and take possession of it, which is what's happened with millions of fans. And so we did the same really with the design, and it happened in the architecture and even the creature designs. Yeah. We'll start with, if we're doing a newspaper, we'll absolutely examine what is the format, the design format of a newspaper, and we'll start with that and then shift it a little bit. So we were inventing a new language, it's true, but we always start with a reality that we can build on
and make everything go crazy, because the wizarding world is crazy and hilarious as well, no? So we had to keep that on our graphics as well.
Because I was going to ask you, I mean, how different it was from your former cinema experience in Brazil, from the type of film you were doing there? I mean, for this, for example.
Now, that has been brilliant, because I did graphic design in Brazil as a degree course, but I never worked doing graphics in Brazil. I was working editing. When I first went there to meet Mira, I was so shocked, like the size of everything. The art department was massive, and the sets and everything was so, yeah, like proper Hollywood film. And I never saw that back in Brazil.
And of course, I'm here to talk about, you know, there's a new spin-off series of Harry Potter, Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them, which is doing very well at the box office at the moment. I mean, it's crazy. So the Harry Potter, you know, the whole fans, they are very excited. But tell us about this project, House of Minalima, which is currently in Soho as well. I want to know more about this.
Yeah, well, this is kind of like by osmosis almost, without us realizing, it's become the kind of baby of both of our experiences of working in film, because we've done exhibitions before where we've exhibited our graphic design work, which we sell as limited edition prints of the film designs. But we've never thought until now to put it in an environment that is a story in itself. And now that we've done it, it feels like the most obvious statement that we could make as designers. So we found a really interesting building that was very in keeping with the whole Harry Potter universe.
It looks like a house that could have been in Diagon Alley easily, no?
Yeah, exactly. And once we found that kind of skeleton of a building, we decided that should be part of the exhibit as well, not just the work. So we very much embraced what we had found and treated it a bit like a film set. So decorated it with the right, themed the rooms, chose everything from the sort of flooring to walls to lighting to furniture and decorations, and then created this environment that the work could sit within and become part of the story. And we're really proud of that, because it feels like much more of a statement of who we are as designers than putting our work on its own on a white wall, which is lovely, but it's not true to where the works come from in the first place. Our background is storytelling and working in cinema. So it's been now we've done it, we want to keep doing it. And we've discovered that the building's not even big enough, the four stories, now that we'll be working on more films and there'll be more material, plus all the other work that we've done that's not for the Harry Potter franchise, needs space. So somehow we've got to invent
this massive house. No,
and here in Monaco, we're very, we do like the print product. And it's interesting because you do that for a film. So, for example, I have a series of images. For example, there's the Daily Prophet here. So it's quite interesting because you guys are working, it's not a real magazine in the technical terms, but it's quite interesting. You also have, you can say you have experience in how to make a magazine in a way, or interesting posters as well.
Yeah, because the graphic design for film is not really like the kind of normal graphic designer that job would do. But at the same time, we do a bit of everything that other graphic designers do. So we do branding, we do magazine design, we do layout, we do book design, we
do
pattern.
But we have the freedom of being, not constrained by perhaps technical processes or distribution or production, because we can pretty much control, if we're doing a magazine, we might need to make 30 of them, not 30,000.
So we can emboss and we can use like foiling and things that not normally in a magazine you wouldn't do that because it would be too expensive to. But in the films we can do that, especially on Harry Potter Fantastic Beasts.
There's some great techniques that you guys use, like how to age as well, like some newspaper. Yeah. Because of course the film is not in the current times, it's in the 20s, correct me if I'm wrong.
Yes, yeah. And actually it's worth mentioning that because it's a really important part of the creation of a prop in order to tell the story. So if it's a book that's from the 17th century and you've been given it and it's really valuable, we need to try and describe its history in that one prop. And that's not just in its design of the pages or the cover, but it might be how we age it or what kind of gilding it's got. And so all of those little details are all helping tell the story, and that's what we have to put first every time we make a decision about design, is who made this thing, where did it come from, how can the audience accept its provenance and its legacy, and rather than us just doing a cool design.
Well, our aging techniques are very,
very high end. We can't possibly go into
and guys, for those, not all our listeners are based in London, can you buy some of those products online, for example, no matter.
Absolutely. Everything that we exhibit in the house is on our website, minalima.com, and all the prints are for sale. And we have quite a vast range now of stationery as well, with sort of lower end price point. We ship all around the world by owl.
Mirafora Mina and Eduardo Lima of Minalima Design speaking to Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco. The original prints from Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them are currently on display at the House of Minalima in Soho until the 4th of February. And that's it for this week's program. Thanks to our editor, Claire Urban. If you fancy picking up any of the titles we mention here on The Stack, do pay us a visit over at the Kiosk Cafe. That's Monocle's very own newsstand in Paddington, right here in London. You've been listening to The Stack. I'm Ben Ryland. Until next time, it's goodbye from me.